Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. In West Virginia, residents are concerned about their water supply as the gas drilling industry expands.
And as a surface owner, I feel we are bulldozed. We are treated like we don't exist, and nobody cares.
Scientific jargon is discouraged in Pennsylvania for the sake of climate change education.
We have to accept that we don't live in a world where scientists can simply do the science, publish it, and assume that it will translate to good public policy. It doesn't work that way.
You'll find these stories and more this week Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The Marcellus Shale runs through several Appalachian states. According to the Department of Revenue, severance tax income from West Virginia's natural gas industry is beginning to balance out the bust of the coal industry. But that growth can be seen in more than just revenue numbers. It's evident in truck traffic and crowded hotel parking lots, and certainly to anyone who travels the back roads throughout northern West Virginia. The latest figures from the Department of Environmental Protection indicate that there are upwards of 400 horizontal wells in the state. But what does that really mean? How many more wells will there be? Glynis Board of West Virginia Public Radio brings us a snapshot of where the natural gas industry growth is in the state today and where you can see it for yourself.
If you travel through northern West Virginia these days, especially along any of the rural roads, it won't take long to stumble upon one of the 5-acre, leveled off, lit up horizontal drill pads. Depending on which stage the operation is in, you might see giant tanks, diesel generators, any number of large, white, heavy-duty pickup trucks. I don't know why they're always white, but there seems to be an industry rule there. You might also see a towering structure. That's a drilling rig. It's temporary. They move from pad to pad to actually drill these impressively deep horizontal wells. Each pad might have anywhere from one to many wells drilled into it. John Kearney is an environmental resource analyst in the DEP's Office of Oil and Gas. He says over 1,300 of these wells reported production in 2013. As of last week, applications for 209 more are pending. It will take each application between 60 and 90 days to be approved. Kearney says the number of applications the DEP receives each month has been fairly steady and consistent over the last several years.
Our dashboard, one of our features on the website, does plot that. I just pulled up 2014. So this year has varied between 35 and 72 applications received per month.
Kearney is referring to information on the DEP's website. Under the Office of Oil and Gas, there are options to explore applications and permits. And in the description of each permit, there's a link to that well's location on an interactive map.
The public accessible map that shows locations of the wells in West Virginia across the state. It's been in existence in one form or the other for at least 10 or 15 years.
But it's gotten a lot more interesting in recent years. You can see not only where each projected and finished well is, but also who drilled it, when, what rock formation the well is drilling into, how much oil and gas is being produced, and the direction and lengths of the underground bores.
If there's no production data with it, that means that they haven't reported production on it yet. And it could be because it's not completed yet, or that it's been recently completed.
Kearney explains that regulations require companies to report how much gas they produce once a year. That data is then linked to the map.
What the map doesn't show you are things like when a well is going into production, nor can you see all of the ancillary facilities associated with the horizontal wells. Right now, those would include 166 so-called midstream compressor stations and 17 natural gas processing plants, sometimes called extraction facilities.
DEP officials explain there's a long list of processing oils and gases go through, and many companies who manage the product from when it comes out of the ground to when it arrives to consumers, whether those consumers be residents, a cracker plant, or a power station. In this country, or abroad. Looking forward, it's hard to say how many more horizontal wells West Virginia will see. Just for some perspective, though, Pennsylvania, which has seen a lot more natural gas development, is home to more than 7,000 active horizontal wells compared to West Virginia's 1,300. Greene County, just over the state lines, has more than 700.
Current projections forecast another 50 years of natural gas drilling, and plans have just been announced to add another major gas transmission line running from this area south through the Carolinas. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
And in Lewis County, West Virginia, residents are beginning to find out details about CONSOL Energy's plans to expand oil and gas development in their area. The company says they will begin hydraulic fracturing as early as next January. Hundreds of people crowded into a tight assembly hall recently at Jackson's Mill to attend a public forum about what the energy company is planning. The prospect of hydraulic fracturing in the area is prompting excitement, but also concerns, as Roxy Todd of West Virginia Public Radio reports.
This is the Marcellus Shale. So this is a piece of Marcellus Shale from central Lewis County.
Craig Edmonds is a geologist for CONSOL. In his hand, he holds a dense gray rock that came from about 7,000 feet beneath the surface of Lewis County. He's standing beside a map, which shows CONSOL's future plans to drill for natural gas using hydraulic fracturing. Just outside the building, a line of about 200 people wait their turn to talk to CONSOL. Many of them own land or royalties in Lewis County. Jackie Smith is one of them.
We need gas, so therefore we don't have to depend on other countries. Jobs, and we do definitely need jobs in Lewis County.
Exactly how many new well pads is CONSOL planning to build, and where will they be? That is the question almost everyone here is asking, no matter which side of the issue they stand. Barbara Volk is a horse podiatrist, and she has a small farm in Camden. She heard tonight that CONSOL would like to eventually build a well pad along Churchville Road, about 4.5 miles from her farm. That well pad would be along the same creek that her horses drink from. She's worried that if this water becomes polluted, she won't have another supply of water for her farm.
And as a surface owner, I feel we are bulldozed. We are treated like we don't exist, and nobody cares. I did actually speak with someone, and he assured me that everything is going to be according to EPA regulations and that the environment will be protected and the water will be protected. But frankly, from what I have seen in Doddridge County and surrounding areas, I don't believe that's going to be the case.
My name is Jeremy Jones. I'm with CONSOL Energy. I'm the asset manager for the Southern Marcellus region. To date, we have had no impact on any of these Marcellus well site locations that showed that we have reduced the quality of the drinking water in the area. The main thing that we do as far as a water protection standpoint is do pre- and post-drill surveys of water quality analysis within a 2,500-foot radius of our Marcellus well pads.
Jones says that within the next year, CONSOL plans to build at least 2 to 3 new well pads. One of those is nearly finished, and the company plans to begin drilling next January.
Driving out here this evening to Jackson's Mill, you'll see several water truck and service companies that are rebounding from the activity that's already occurring. Marcellus Shale Coalition states that one well will create up to 450 jobs throughout 150 disciplines per well.
Those jobs, however, will only last for a short period of time, mostly during the construction of well pads. Alan Shaw says he's not convinced that energy companies like CONSOL will even employ many local people.
They tell you about all the jobs that they're bringing here and all. I've almost been run over several times in the middle of the road by trucks from Texas, trucks from Oklahoma, trucks from Florida. They're not giving these jobs to these people. They're not even changing their tags, probably not even paying taxes here.
Shaw lives in Camden, in one of the areas that could see new drilling in the next few years. He says he came to this meeting to talk about his concerns, but there was not an opportunity for public comment. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Roxy Todd in Jane Lou.
For the last 10 years, a mystery has been unfolding in the Susquehanna watershed in Pennsylvania. Young smallmouth bass have been found with open sores and lesions. Many of the male fish that make it to adulthood have female sexual characteristics. The smallmouth bass population has dropped, threatening the state's $3 billion recreational fishing industry. What's causing these strange symptoms? State Impact Pennsylvania's Katie Culinary spoke with some of the detectives on the case and some people who are impatient with how long it's taking to solve it.
Dr. William Yingling has been fishing for smallmouth bass on the Susquehanna River for 56 years. The retired physician remembers the day in March 2010 when he saw something he'd never seen on a bass before, black splotches on its olive-colored skin.
I looked at it, and the first thing I thought of was that it looked like a mole or a nevus that human beings have. And I thought, well, why did the bass have this?
The black spots are just one of the bizarre symptoms anglers have noticed in some of the smallmouth bass they pull out of the Susquehanna. Starting in 2005, the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission has reported several outbreaks of infectious disease in the young bass that have open sores and lesions on their scales. Researchers have also found intersex fish, adult male bass with female eggs in their testes, since the early 2000s. The State Department of Environmental Protection is studying the mystery and doesn't know what's causing these problems. That irritates some anglers like Dr. Yingling, who believes the culprit is more obvious than the DEP admits.
If we don't limit the amount of chemical pollution going into this river, we're not going to have any smallmouth bass left.
But zeroing in on precisely which chemicals are affecting the smallmouth bass and where they're coming from is proving to be a difficult task for state investigators. DEP biologist Josh Lookinbill steers a motorboat under the Rockville Bridge over the Susquehanna River, just north of Harrisburg. He drops anchor and lowers in a cylindrical water quality meter. Okay, so since 2012, the DEP has been trying to figure out if the issues with the smallmouth bass could be signs of a bigger problem in the river. Lookinbill says the department is measuring levels of more traditional pollutants, metals, sediment, and nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus. The agency has also tested the water for more than 200 compounds known as emerging contaminants.
The pharmaceuticals, the wastewater treatment compounds, and other endocrine disrupting compounds.
Scientists are still studying their effects, but these compounds may tamper with the body's hormone systems, and smallmouth bass seem to be especially sensitive to them. Lookinbill says it's too soon for the DEP to name a direct cause for the bass's troubles.
We started sampling them approximately 2-3 years ago, and we're just starting to get results from that. So if there's something to tell about that, it's going to take a little bit of time.
In June, a study by the U.S. Geological Survey found the effects of these endocrine-disrupting chemicals were more widespread than previously thought. Researchers found intersex smallmouth bass in 3 Pennsylvania watersheds, including the Ohio and the Delaware rivers. But the highest numbers were found in the Susquehanna.
What I think is that the same chemicals that are inducing the intersex are also affecting the disease resistance mechanisms of the fish.
Biologist Vicki Blazer led the USGS study. Over the last decade, Blazer has found intersex bass elsewhere in the Chesapeake watershed, including the Potomac River, where fish were also showing signs of disease. Her research shows there could be a correlation between the high percentage of land used for farming in the Susquehanna watershed and the high number of affected fish. John Arway is executive director of the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission. In July, he wrote a letter to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency begging for help. He notes Ohio and Virginia have recently passed laws to cut down on the amount of pollution from farming ending up in the rivers.
So this is happening all around us, but We still haven't taken action in Pennsylvania.
Arway has also been pushing the DEP to designate the Susquehanna as an impaired river. He believes that could force the state to take actions that would lower pollution levels and help the bass recover. The DEP says it doesn't have enough data yet to decide whether the river is impaired and suggests the water quality may actually be improving. Arway accuses the agency of dragging its feet.
If I walked into a doctor's office in 2005 and said that I've got sores and lesions on me, it wouldn't have taken 9 years for the doctor to figure out what was causing the sores and lesions.
Last month, state and federal officials sat down to work out a new plan to narrow down the wide range of possible causes for the bass's problems. That work could take at least another year. Biologist Vicki Blazer with the USGS says she appreciates Arway's frustration.
Because I feel the same way. Because it's not something that's easy to get a handle on. And, you know, we have fish that are exposed to complex mixtures.
Those mixtures not only include runoff from farms, but also the chemicals from our own lifestyles that are washed into rivers and streams.
So everybody wants the perfect lawn, and they spread herbicides all over, and, you know, they're concerned about bacteria, so they're using antimicrobial soaps and other things that have these chemicals in.
Blazer says we need to accept there may not be just one culprit in the curious case of the smallmouth bass, and that we all could be guilty as charged. Katie Colinari, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
It's time to explore What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. Certainly, there's nothing bland about the colorful Commonwealth of Virginia, and yet there is. Find out how after the break. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. So what's in the name of Bland County, Virginia? Well, Bland County is said to have been named for Richard Bland, a leader of colonial Virginia's resistance to Great Britain in the 1760s and 1770s. A Virginia statesman, Bland served in the House of Burgesses, which was the first legislative assembly of elected representatives in North America and the Continental Congress. Bland County was formed from Giles, Wythe, and Tazewell counties in 1861, and another part of Giles was added later. The people of the area had become dissatisfied with the distance to the various county seats. There was also great dissatisfaction with taxes paid for the benefit of those far removed from the rugged mountains and valleys of Bland. Its area is 369 square miles, and the county seat is Bland. As of the 2010 census, the county population was 6,824, making it the sixth least populated county in Virginia. Bland County is also one of the few counties in the United States that does not contain any incorporated municipalities. If you have another story about Bland or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at InAppalachia and we might explore it inside Appalachia. Appalachian coal miners are suffering from the most severe form of black lung disease at levels not seen since the early 1970s, according to recent data from the National Institute of Occupational Health and Safety. A study for the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health revealed that the prevalence of black lung disease in West Virginia, Virginia, and Kentucky coal miners has hit a level not seen since the early 1970s. The rate comes despite federal laws and regulations meant to control dust in coal mines, limit miner exposure, and eradicate the disease. Reporters with WFPL spoke with Evan Smith, an attorney with the Appalachian Citizens Law Center in Kentucky.
What we've seen since, especially the 80s, is that there's been under enforcement of the rules. There's been major loopholes that have meant that even if you look at the book and say this is what the dust level is, that's not what miners have been exposed to.
Operations are mining thinner seams, which means more sandstone and rock, which causes the most deadly form of black lung.
The mix of dust that they're being exposed to isn't as much as sort of just pure coal as, you know, what maybe my grandfather would have been breathing. Instead, there's a lot more rock and sandstone, shale, and what's in those rocks ends up being more damaging to miners' lungs.
Smith says federal regulations also haven't always been followed, and there were numerous loopholes. The report comes on the heels of new federal limits on dust exposure meant to close those loopholes. Black lung disease was part of the discussion in the first of a series of public health dialogues in West Virginia. The School of Public Health at West Virginia University is hosting the discussion to explore the socioeconomic reasons for decades of poor health in the state. Panelists included a physician, an investigative journalist, and a policy analyst. Glennis Board of West Virginia Public Radio has the report.
Dozens clustered in the hallways of WVU's Health Sciences Center in Morgantown to participate in the first of four events hosted by the School of Public Health. The title, Black Lung and Chemical Spills, 100 Years of Poor Health in West Virginia. The dialogue was designed to explore our history and what we can change to improve social, economic, and health outcomes in the future. One panelist, Dr. Stephen Wolfe, is the director of the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University. His research most recently explores social determinants of health. He brought a national perspective on West Virginia's health disparities.
I had the opportunity to chair a National Research Council panel that compared the health of Americans with people in 16 peer countries. And what it shows is that Americans are sicker and die earlier than people in those other countries. And that's been going on since 1980, perhaps earlier, and it's getting progressively worse, the disparity in life expectancy and health between us and other countries.
And Wolf says it's not just the impoverished communities who are worse off.
Clearly it's worse for the poor and minorities, but we studied rich Americans and found that they die earlier than rich people in other countries. Whites die earlier than whites in other countries. College-educated Americans die earlier than college-educated people in other countries. There's something systemic going on in our society because of these social and economic problems that affects all classes.
We're in this together, Wolf said. His comments are echoed by another panelist, Ted Bettner, executive director of a policy think tank based in Charleston, the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy. Bettner also offered ideas about which disparities are most critical to address, namely supporting young families, many of which are caught in impoverished, chaotic cycles.
I think dealing with early intervention and early childhood programs is the best place that we can put our resources. We're not doing enough compared to other states, and we need to do a tremendous amount to turn that around.
Since the 90s, research on ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences, has shed light on how stressful childhood experiences like divorce, temporary abandonment, poor nutrition, and chaotic home and neighborhood life in general can have lasting negative impacts. Obesity, dependency and addiction problems, stroke, emphysema. Dr. Wolf says more recent research is proving how this toxic stress renders children significantly more likely to develop these problems.
Being exposed to that toxic stress actually causes biologic changes in the developing bodies of young people. This is a time where the brain is developing, and it causes permanent changes in the nervous system and the development of the brain that causes changes in behavior, greater need for dependency and addiction in order to cope, and changes in the immune system and the physiology of end organs that actually set the body on a course for adult diseases like diabetes and heart disease.
Bettner reports, in West Virginia, investing in early childhood intervention programs is something groups in the state are working on expanding, and that's likely to have major payoffs in terms of decreasing rates of incarceration, teen pregnancy, and other indications of poor health in our communities and economy.
If you leave it up just to the legislators, it's probably not going to happen because kids can't write campaign checks. Kids cannot vote.
He contends communities and faith and business leaders collaborating to find and enact solutions that fit each region's needs is how we will overcome challenges we continue to face. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
The Federal Environmental Protection Agency's proposed rules to regulate carbon emissions has been a hot topic throughout Appalachia lately. The rules surround the discussion of climate change, once referred to as global warming. Most reporters are not scientists. Instead, we rely on the type of scientist who is good at telling stories, good at translating what happens in the lab to people who may not have been around an Erlenmeyer flask since high school. So what makes a scientist a good communicator? State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips looks at how the scientific community has become more interested in figuring that out.
Okay, what if you heard?
The change in net irradiance at the tropopause after allowing for stratospheric temperatures to readjust to radiative equilibrium.
Are you following? Me neither. But what if he said,
the sun shines down on Earth, warming our oceans, burning our skin, heating the asphalt. The numbers suggest more and more the heat is getting absorbed by the Earth and its inhabitants, and less is being reflected out into space. This makes the Earth hotter.
Well, now you know I'm describing global warming. Scientists face a struggle all the time. How to talk about their work in a way that everyone gets, but remains true to the science. And how not to wince the next day when the headlines miss the nuances in what they tried to say. 29-year-old Christina Love teaches physics at Drexel University. During her years of science education, she got no formal training in how to communicate with non-scientists, and that's not unusual.
So this is kind of the current model of our galaxy. So you see these beautiful pictures of our galaxy. One model shows for dark matter that the galaxy's deep way down in this huge spherical halo of dark matter. We're surrounded by it. And so it's here, but you can't detect it. And that's the idea.
Love is in a room full of scientists at the Chemical Heritage Foundation in Center City, Philadelphia. They're standing around posters explaining their work. Get-togethers like this are something scientists do all the time with other scientists. But this time, this event is open to the public. And scientific jargon, it's discouraged. Love organized this event called Start Talking Science to coax scientists to talk about their work in a more accessible way to non-experts.
When I first learned about dark matter, I was an undergraduate at Westchester, and I really wanted to scream. I thought, how is this possible? How have I not known this up until now? I went through all of, you know, my grade school and high school thinking we know everything, and it turns out what we know is less than 5% of the entire universe. So there's just some really amazing things out there that that everyone deserves to know and understand.
In the last 10 years, major scientific societies have begun holding workshops on communications. Some have even established big money prizes to promote the idea. Naomi Oreskes teaches the history of science at Harvard, and she's written extensively about funding for climate change skeptics.
There's definitely been a change from a feeling 10 years ago that it was the job of scientists to do the science, as well and as accurately as possible, but that it was really someone else's job to communicate it. And most scientists I knew and I talked to really thought it was your job, that it was the job of science journalists. And scientists used to get mad because they felt that science journalists did a poor job.
Oreskes says controversies around politically charged topics, such as climate change, have led a lot of scientists to rethink how they talk about their work. If the science is complicated, she says, it's a delicate art to simplify without dumbing it down.
I always like to say it's not dumbing it down, it's cleaning it up, right? But how to make that clean up, how to sort of polish it and make it presentable in a way that's not misleading, it's not trivial.
She says one of the best science communicators to emerge from the lab into the public sphere is this guy.
We have to accept that we don't live in a world where scientists can simply do the science, publish it, and assume that it will translate to good public policy. It doesn't work that way.
That's Penn State climate scientist Michael Mann. If he sounds like he's on the warpath for better science communication, he is.
We have to be out there defending the science, informing the electorate, explaining the science and its implications, because if we don't, it means special interests, front groups, paid attack dogs will simply poison the discussion with misinformation and disinformation.
Mann's views are shaped by personal experience. In 1998, he co-authored a paper that looked at weather patterns from medieval times by analyzing ice cores and tree rings. And in this paper was a simple little graph, one he thought pretty uninteresting. But the graph communicated his findings so well, so easily, to a lay audience that it got a lot of press. Then he became a top target for those who claim climate change is a hoax. He was called before Congress. His emails were hacked. At one point, in a national magazine, he was referred to as the, quote, Jerry Sandusky of climate change.
I never envisioned that majoring in physics and applied math and going into the study of the climate system would place me at the center of, you know, what may be the most contentious debate that we have faced as a society. I didn't sign up for that.
But now man has embraced it. That iconic chart is now known as the hockey stick graph. It shows how the average temperature of the Earth has risen dramatically since the start of the Industrial Revolution. Mann wrote a book on his experiences, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Mann says back before the famous graph, he was pretty naive and just wanted to stay in his lab doing nerdy calculations. He's now an advocate for scientists to get out of their bunkers and engage the public.
And part of that is using metaphors and thinking, trying to get outside of your own scientific comprehension of the issue and think about how, you know, how would I think about this if I wasn't a climate scientist, if I wasn't a scientist at all?
Mann says the challenges include widespread misconceptions about the scientific process.
We don't prove things in science. We establish, you know, best explanations for observed phenomena. We apply, you know, weights of evidence. We pose hypotheses, and then we look at the observations and we see if they support the hypotheses. And it's this iterative process. There are huge uncertainties at the base of every area of science. That doesn't mean that we know nothing.
Mann and Oreskes, the Harvard professor, agree that the problem for scientists is not just a lack of skill or comfort with public speaking. Science sits at the center of many major public policy debates. Economic interests on both sides look for science that supports their position and will attack findings that don't. That point is not lost on younger scientists like physicist Christina Love.
It's almost a fear of not explaining it properly and then all of a sudden becoming the next controversy. So you kind of see that with evolution and with climate change, and at the risk of getting cosmologists in trouble, I don't really feel like the Big Bang Theory is attacked all that much. And I don't really understand why it isn't.
Maybe the explanation is that even though some think the Big Bang conflicts with the Bible, the theory doesn't really threaten anyone's livelihood. Yet. I'm Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
This is Inside Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from State Impact, Pennsylvania, West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and NPR. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at @InAppalachia or at @WVJessicaYLilly. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.